Welcome back to The Rose Report, a podcast where lawyers break down legal issues embedded in current events. I'm Madeline Braggs.
I'm Owen Lennitz.
And I'm Dan Gauthier. This podcast is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship.
The Super Bowl is once again coming to Arizona, and many economists are very excited. Besides tourism dollars, it does bring up a question of short-term rentals. But here to get into all of that is Rose Law Group attorney Thomas Galvin. Thanks for coming on. And where should we start? We've done a lot of work this year with some sports teams and getting sports betting up. Sports betting was legalized this year. So tell us what that was like working on those cases and seeing that come up.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Governor Ducey deserves a lot of credit for cobbling together different stakeholders and coalitions and working with the Native American tribes to update the Arizona Gaming Compact. However, alongside with that, which allowed the Arizona tribes to have a lot more different types of gaming options available at their casinos, Arizona now has sports gambling, which was, you know, effectively legalized by the U.S. Supreme Court a couple of years ago, which said that states can't prohibit legalized sports gambling. And what happened there was that Arizona set up 20 sports gambling licenses. 10 have been allocated for the tribes here in Arizona, and then 10 are what they call non-tribal gaming licenses. And this would allow the local professional sports teams, the NASCAR Motorsports, and the PGA Tour, which is a Rose Law Group client, to be the possessors of these licenses. But they actually work with the gaming operators, which include, you know, many names that people know, like FanDuel and DraftKings.
So the licenses are awarded to the tribal communities, so the tribes, the 10 tribes throughout the state, and 10 more to essentially professional sports organizations throughout the state.
Right. And so there was actually more than 10 tribes that applied for those 10 tribal licenses, which is really interesting. And they had to go through a process with the Arizona Department of Gaming to decide which of those 10 tribes would be awarded those sports gambling licenses. On the other hand, the thinking was for the 10 non-tribal licenses to go for what is colloquially known as the sports teams. Is the thinking is that, you know, these sports teams are local, right? They're attached to the community. They're rooted in the community. They're part of Arizona. So let's say the Phoenix Suns, the Arizona Cardinals, the Diamondbacks, and then obviously the non-team leagues, including NASCAR and PGA Tour. But yeah, the licenses go with them, but effectively they go through companies like DraftKings.
Tom, is there a threshold in terms of income the sports team generates or fan base or some sort of quantifier?
Yep, absolutely. Great question. So for the non-tribal licenses, yes, the definition was that you had to be either a professional sports team operating in Arizona or operating at the highest level of your league or sport. And then there's other criteria involved, including, you know, if you're a professional sports team, the capacity of the arena that you play in. So you can't be, you know, just a Quidditch team or a local Arizona, you know, adult rec league soccer team. You have to be an actual professional team performing at the highest level of your sport. So this qualifies for, you know, a 20,000 seat arena. If you are PGA Tour, which actually, you know, doesn't have an arena itself, but is considered to be the highest level of golf, that would certainly qualify. And this is to figure out, you know, minor league teams, so to speak, couldn't qualify to have these non-tribal gambling licenses.
So the tribes received their licenses, the sports teams received their license, and you've mentioned a few times that, you know, the FanDuels, the DraftKings, the actual operators get involved. You want to talk a little bit about how that works?
Yes.
I mean, is it as simple as the sports teams calling up, you know, the FanDuel and licensing them the right to operate?
Kind of, sort of, but obviously it depends and it's very complicated. But I think the Arizona Department of Gaming did a really good job in a short period of time of setting up the scheme for how these teams are able to work with professional operators to get these licenses up and running. So after the bill passed, but before everything went into effect, and the goal was to get into effect by early September because the NFL season was starting and professional football is by far the most bet on sport in the United States. All summer last year, Arizona Department of Gaming had these work study sessions where they're vetting all these different issues and questions. And it was really good because they're getting a lot of feedback from these folks in the industry who really know how it works. But in many ways, the Department of Gaming
was leading the charge here. They had an agenda and they knew exactly what they're going to do. But when you do the application, and we worked with a client here on an application, you have to show the Department of Gaming who the operator would be, how long they've been in operation, the expertise, and all that. And all of those things went into the criteria of you being awarded the license. And, you know, FanDuel and DraftKings, even though they have the vast majority of market share, you know, because there's 20 licenses out there, there would be potentially 20 different operators working with these license holders. So there's a lot of companies like, you know, even BetMGM that's on there. And you guys could probably throw out a few other names that people might have heard of. And obviously a lot of other companies that people might not have heard of as well. But all of these companies were vetted the same way by the Department of Gaming to have that operator license with these teams.
So how does a city go about the process of hosting a Super Bowl?
Okay. So Super Bowl, yeah, that's a whole different ball of wax. But, you know, cities compete to host a Super Bowl. It is such a big financial windfall. It's also such a great way to generate good publicity for your city. The NFL likes to award Super Bowl host cities years in advance. So this year was just hosted by Los Angeles, which just has the brand new SoFi Stadium, which costs several billion dollars. Next year is here in Arizona, which is very exciting. This will be the fourth time that Arizona has hosted it, the third time that State Farm Stadium has hosted it. And then in subsequent years, it'll be in Las Vegas. It'll be in New Orleans. One of the main reasons why the NFL looks at cities to host a Super Bowl is, can you handle all of the people that will be there? So they look at hotel rooms. They look at highway access, airport access, you know, transportation, all of those issues. And then, you know, restaurants, obviously. Another issue that is very good with the NFL is, do you have a new stadium? So if LA builds a new stadium, they're going to get a Super Bowl. Las Vegas just built a new stadium. They're going to get a Super Bowl. But obviously another good criteria is weather. It used to be that the NFL liked to have Super Bowl cities in southern states, right? The Sun Belt. But lately, you know, a lot of stadiums are now are weatherproof, right? There's a lot of dome stadiums. So recently Minnesota had one. But that's another criteria. In Arizona, consistently, is almost on an 8-year cycle to host a Super Bowl, primarily because of our great weather and our great transportation and abundance of hotel rooms.
Okay. So how can cities, when they're still in their planning stages, how can they go about developing in a way that's mindful for those like big sports events in the future?
Well, I think, you know, if cities have experience hosting good events and big events, like obviously the Valley hosts the Phoenix Open every year. We do a good job of that. And next year, the Phoenix Open and the Super Bowl are going to be the same weekend. So obviously the NFL believes that the Valley can handle both huge events at the same time, which will be exciting for us. You know, New Orleans obviously hosts big events all the time, and Vegas does as well. So those cities know exactly what they're doing. They host huge events all the time. But the NFL is the biggest one of all. But the NFL definitely looks at whether or not cities are capable of handling, you know, all the infrastructure and all the hoopla that comes with it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think I read an article on next year's Super Bowl. They're going to make sure that the final round of the Open on Sunday is done by, I think, 12:30 or something. Plenty of time for buses and Ubers to bring everyone at the Open.
The only Sundays I've been to at the Phoenix Open was when they had the Super Bowl here last time. And I remember I went really early in the morning and it was all fog and you could barely see the course, but it was really fun because it was actually nice and quiet. I always say going on Sunday morning to the Phoenix Open is probably the most chill way to go. Yeah. Especially in Super Bowl weekend.
Yeah. Everyone on Saturday isn't quite up yet and back on Sunday.
Yeah. I think the last 2 years, speaking of the Super Bowl, was the first 2 years, and it's been back to back now, that the host city team won.
I know, right?
And so hopefully we make it 3-for-3 with the Cardinals. Yeah.
Well, the Broncos, the Seahawks just traded Russell Wilson to the Broncos.
Just today.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Breaking news. So, you know, that helps a lot of the West for the Cardinals.
So I saw that Fox 10 reported that just in the first month that legal sports betting here in Arizona was a thing, that almost 300 million bets were placed, and that was the highest debut for legal sports betting ever. And then the following months, of course, just got bigger and bigger. You'd think that everyone living in Arizona would be excited about all this economic opportunity for a state. However, there are the groups of people who not like living in neighborhoods with Airbnbs and short-term rentals, and those groups maybe are not as excited with all this tourism coming in. So tell us a little bit about why people are opposed to short-term rentals and why that can maybe cause some friction in the year that the Super Bowl comes back.
Yeah, I think with Airbnb type, you know, vacation rental share, home sharing, there's been a lot of unintended consequences. Look at Sedona, where a lot of people started buying these homes up there as investment properties and decided to turn around and make them available for home sharing. But the local residents who've been in Sedona up there for many years are now up in arms. Just think about also, you know, just like a Super Bowl, but for them, it's a Super Bowl every weekend. Just think about the drain and the exacerbation on all the resources there, right? You go up to Sedona now, it's just packed on weekends, and it doesn't matter what time of year it is. And so I've been at hearings up in Sedona for various cases where people are complaining about the development going up there. And one of the issues they complain about is the lack of housing, right? Because it's impossible to find housing for people who work at the resorts in Sedona because they're unable to live in these homes because these homes are being rented out on a daily basis. Same thing in Scottsdale, Paradise Valley, Arcadia, other parts here in the Valley. People complain about parties. I think that's the biggest issue going on right now. But, you know, the city of Phoenix, I know, has very good rules and strict rules that if you're going to have an Airbnb, you have to register with the city of Phoenix. If people complain and notify the police and the police call you, you have to get back to the police within a certain period of time. I think it's several hours, maybe even 1 hour. All of those reasons and all of those new rules that have been promulgated have been in direct response to all the issues that have come up with these home sharing type events.
It's an interesting framework that's sort of taken place because I don't know if our listeners are aware, but in Arizona, you're limited, the cities and local jurisdictions are limited in how much they can and can't regulate short-term rentals, just generally speaking. So you see cities like Phoenix and Scottsdale that enact these rules, registration rules, mm-hmm. notification rules, to try and keep their hands around it. But they are limited in what they can do in that they aren't permitted to prohibit short-term rentals in their jurisdiction. So what we see homeowners associations across the state doing their part to try and regulate. I know we at the firm have been involved in many cases with, on both sides of associations trying to prohibit and trying to allow and, you know, fighting for and fighting against short-term rentals. Do you want to talk a little bit about, you know, the typical restrictions that a homeowners association would try to put on short-term rentals and, you know, what that maybe looks like?
Like you said, we've dealt with that pretty frequently last year or two on both sides of it. And I think it really comes down to looking at the CC&Rs that are in place or any declarations, any covenants that run with your property when you buy. That's frankly one of the reasons when I bought my home, I went outside of an HOA neighborhood because I didn't want to have to worry about that. I didn't want to have any restrictions on how I paint my house. Now, granted, I live in a historic, so I have other constraints on my property, but I'm fine with those. So definitely if you live in an HOA community and that's something you want to do, take a look. Keep in mind, we're seeing a lot of, I've had two, I think now, in the last year, clients who've come and said, well, they're trying to amend the CC&Rs to specifically restrict this. Can they do that? And, well, if they do it appropriately, yeah, they can. There's nothing you can do to stop them from doing that. There's potentially the argument you can make that, well, I detrimentally relied on my review of the amendment or the declaration when I first moved in, knowing I was going to do this. But that argument doesn't go too far unless, you know, you went to a board meeting or something and they told you, yeah, there's no plan on amending this. We're all happy with it. And then 2 months in, you living there, they say, well, we're actually going to get a majority amendment and restrict that. That being said, if you're a listener out there on either side of the coin, let's say you're one who lives in an HOA not in an HOA and there is a short-term rental in your neighborhood, that doesn't mean you don't have recourse because you could potentially have a private nuisance claim if the house next door is continuously throwing parties or the house that's being rented out is excessive in the volume or, you know, there's trespass continuously ongoing, whether it's humans or, you know, litter, essentially them throwing things over the wall, whatever it might be. There's definitely recourse for the homeowner who wants to preserve the status quo and not be impacted by a short-term rental, but both sides of the coin only go so far.
Yeah, and And you know, the typical response from an association is to impose a daily lease minimum under their CCNR. So they'll be, it's typical to see, you know, a 30-day minimum. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, I've seen, my parents actually live outside of Sedona, and some of the associations up there do 6-month minimums. And so really, as long as you have a mass to pass a CCNR amendment, and there, so there's support for it, as long as it's not done in a discriminatory manner, there can be amendments to CCNRs to restrict the association's property, however the voters decide to restrict the property. So, you know, to Olin's point, do your homework, read those restrictions prior to buying what you intend to make a short-term rental. I can't tell you how many times, more than I can count on two hands, where I have calls from clients that received a demand letter to cease and desist operating a short-term rental. And they say, you know, this is impossible. I can't be, you know, Arizona,
it's my house.
Arizona freely allows short-term rentals. It's my house. And we look at the title report, we look at the CCNRs and say, actually, no, the association limits this. And, you know, you're sort of out of luck unless you really want to fight it.
Yeah. Right. You'd be surprised how many people I talk to or have known who think that it is just as easy as downloading the app and saying, you can now book your stay in my house. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, but best way to avoid that is to call us, right? Of course.
We always joke on this podcast, deal with me at the outset so you don't have to deal with Olin later.
Exactly.
This is one of those examples. Exactly.
So I recently went to a Suns game and I saw the FanDuel booth. Yeah. When you go in there, you place a bet. Is that the same as me pulling it up on my phone?
It is the same, but the studies have shown that the vast majority of sports gambling is done on your smartphone. Like mobile gaming is the bulk of the sports gambling industry. So you can go to a physical sports book and have a good time, watch a game, wait for the results, right? If you're betting an over-under on a Suns game against the Thunder, can hang out with your friends and celebrate when you hit that over, if you bet on the over. But the vast majority is, you know, people either at home, they're at their kids' soccer game, they're hanging out with friends at a barbecue, hanging out on the couch, watching a game. And that's where the vast majority of sports gambling is done, is on the actual smartphone. And that's why live betting is so important. And so people are able to make bets. It's quite fascinating where they're able to change the lines on a game in real lifetime. Yeah.
Jan and I were at a Coyotes game and we were getting close to the end of the game. And
without me.
Yeah. Just friends only. And we were debating if we were going to go on the over because it was a high scoring game and they're within one goal. Right, so it would be an empty net. And we ultimately didn't do it, but we were literally talking about that. Yep. Like, it got to a point where they just cut it off because it was just too risky for probably the book to leave that setup, considering how much time was left. Mm-hmm. So I haven't bet at the Suns game or at the stadium. Can you only bet on that active game, or is it the full book?
You can bet anywhere, the full book. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The operators have made it very easy to place bets anywhere at any time, live or in advance.
But everything is geofenced. So if you have a FanDuel account or a DraftKings account and you walk on to one of the tribes and one of the reservations here in Arizona, you're no longer able to make a bet.
Okay.
If you're driving to California and you're checking out the bets, you better do it before you cross the border, because then you won't be able to, because then now you're subject to California law. Yep.
So Tom, you mentioned earlier that the gaming compact was amended as part of the sports betting law that you passed. You want to talk a little bit about how the tribes came out?
Yeah, so the tribes were prohibited the last time the gaming compact was approved by voters decades ago. They were prohibited by offering certain games at their casinos. But now with the new revised gaming compact, they're able to. So this is, you know, the type of games that you most likely see in Las Vegas. But now they're offered here, including, you know, games like roulette that wasn't able to offer before. The tribes, you know, they generate a lot of revenue at these casinos. These casinos are very popular here in Arizona. They have a lot of events like concerts and so forth. And then after concerts, people walk through the gaming floor and they're able to sit down and, you know, make some bets at the slot machines. Now they can do so with these quote unquote Vegas style games like roulette. So I think that was the biggest aspect of the change in the gaming compact from the tribes.
So for our listeners, if you've ever walked into an Arizona casino on tribal land, and you say, wait, where's the Texas No Limit Hold'em, where's the craps and the roulette right. table. Now you know why.
Yep.
The gaming compact used.
But now craps is available.
Now craps is available.
Yeah. They used to have electronic though, right?
Electronic was allowed, but live table right. games were ripped. I think the only one they allowed was blackjack.
Yeah. And now craps and roulette are allowed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So.
I didn't know that. I don't See? Really gamble.
You're learning.
Now I know I can gamble on sports.
Now you don't have to. Well, I actually have a friend who loves craps, and he used to have to go to Vegas to play craps live, and now he's very happy that
I don't know how to play craps. I'm very confused by it.
I'm very confused by
it. That's the rolling sevens?
Yes, that's the set. Yes, that's the.
That's all I know.
So I want to know, now that we have the element of legal betting here, is that adding to the excitement for you guys watching your sports, your favorite sports?
I think, that's what I was mentioning when Dan and I went to the game is, he told me yes. And I see.
Well, Dan said yes.
But I think I will at some point, because I can definitely see the merit in, especially if you're out or, just on the couch. And I think Tom said this too, it's, the end of the game, and it makes it a little more fun. There's something at stake, even if it's just a dollar. You suddenly care what the score between the Knicks and the Wizards is going to be when normally you wouldn't.
I play fantasy football, and I'm in a group chat with 12 crazy guys during football season. And
you're one of the 12.
I'm one of the 12 crazy guys. But, during the season, so much talk came up about the bets that they were making. So while we're all waiting for our fantasy league results to come in throughout the day, my friends are making bets and talking about how it's going and, nothing crazy. But, it's funny when someone gets a bad beat because the Lions score a touchdown at the last second. So that kind of spices up conversations in sports talk, I think. Yeah. And, March Madness is coming. So besides pro football, college basketball, March Madness is a really big deal from a sports gambling perspective. So it'll be really interesting to see how that goes on with my friends, I think, as well. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Anyways. Wonderful. Well, Tom, thank you so much for coming on our show and bringing so many insights.
We'll leave Tom's information in the show notes. And if you have any questions about sports betting or otherwise.
Quick shout out to our number one fan, Kane.
Yes.
Our most loyal listener and partner at the firm.
He gets very excited about these. So, yeah, we're going to start highlighting our favorite listeners or listener of the week at the end of these episodes. We just decided right now.
Yeah.
Kane, you're our number one guy.
You're number one.
Okay, well, tune in on YouTube to watch.
Thanks, guys.